In this second session of our conference, Louise Doswell Beck is going to open for us with a talk on the international humanitarian law aspects of the advisory opinion. Louise.
Thank you very much. I gather that most of you are already fairly familiar with the opinion, so I'm not going to go into detail. Perhaps I should have started by saying how pleased I am to be here, which is true, and I hope that this functions. I think that's the case. I will try not to be too long on this, and therefore I will concentrate on some of the factors that appear to motivate some of the judges to come to certain conclusions as compared with other conclusions. Now, I was asked to talk about the IHL, International Humanitarian Law, I always contract to IHL to make it shorter, aspects of this opinion. And I think I should preface this by saying that there is, on the one hand, the feeling on seeing the kind of effects that were presented to us very briefly this morning. And even Judge Higgins said at the time, the technical analysis is one thing, but it doesn't take into account really the reality. So I think I'd like to echo that aspect. And on the other hand, there are indeed the technical aspects. Why am I saying this, first of all? It's because, in my view, people will tend to, especially lawyers, argue a legal analysis on the basis of the result they want to achieve. And they will use the technicality of the law in order to get to that result. And any good lawyer can do that. But that is what often, though, trips up someone who is faced with this. They'll say, well, you know, what am I supposed to answer to this? It all just sounds so convincing, and it can create some difficulty, which is why what I'd like to try and do is to walk you through some of the points and some of the arguments in order to show perhaps some alternative ways of looking at these technicalities. The first point, which was alluded to this morning by Judge Wermantri, was the fact that the court did say that the lawfulness of the use of nuclear weapons has to be evaluated within the rules of international humanitarian law. That was actually utterly uncontroversial. All the states which made submissions to the court accepted that. The United States, everybody. So that is an uncontroversial point. And therefore, the other uncontroversial point, more or less, was that one can use the basic rules of international humanitarian law in the absence of a treaty to evaluate whether the use would be lawful or not. There were just two states in their submissions, Russia and France, who said the only way you ban a weapon is by a treaty. The other states in their submissions did not say that. They accepted that one has to make an evaluation on the basis of the rules of humanitarian law. That was confirmed by the court's opinion, and that was how the vast majority of judges in their individual opinions undertook the evaluation. So having said that, then the question was, well, what are the major rules? A number of side issues, I would call them side issues, were brought up, namely human rights law, environmental law, which is not a side issue at all, but it was not the center of humanitarian law as discussed in that opinion. Neutrality law, which actually is also important, but for the purposes of today, I'm putting it as a side issue. And they concentrated rather on what they call the two cardinal principles, which I will do now as well. But if there are questions, I'd be very happy to talk about the what I've just mentioned, the side issues, even though, in my view, they are actually fairly important as well. Okay, so the cardinal principles. That is a term for a start which is non-existent in international law, and I have no idea how the International Court of Justice invented this term. Either something is customary law or it isn't, and an evaluation of what is customary law is an entire exercise, as I know, because I'm one of the co-authors of the ICRC study on customary law. Or, even more so, it might be a super customary law, if you like, and it's jus cogens. In other words, it cannot be undermined. You cannot plead another area of international law unless it is more important or supersedes this jus cogens. I have decided I'm not going to talk about jus cogens here. I'm just going to talk about the customary principles so generally understood. So the basic customary law principles under which you evaluate whether a weapon can be lawfully used or not are the ones which provide for the distinction between combatants and non-combatants. In other words, whether weapons are capable of distinguishing between combatants and non-combatants. And in that context, one looks at whether a weapon is indiscriminate. And the second customary law principle is the prohibition of the use of weapons that cause what's called superfluous injury or unnecessary suffering, which the courts described as a harm greater than that unavoidable to achieve legitimate military objectives, which I think is not a bad summary of what that means. And I would like to take these two and examine them a bit in the context of what the courts said, the various judges had to say. I'll start off with the second one I mentioned, the prohibition of superfluous injury or unnecessary suffering. It basically prohibits excessively cruel weapons. In other words, if one can use a certain type of weapon to achieve a particular military result, then using a weapon which creates more damaging, more suffering than that which is necessary to achieve that particular military result becomes excessive and therefore violates this principle. Now, what we had in the opinion of the judges, all the judges mentioned this, but then hardly analysed it afterwards, with the exception of Judge Higgins, and in an implied fashion, Judge Guillaume. Judge Higgins in particular, who's the only one who actually, I think, tried to make what we lawyers would call a positivist evaluation, to say looking at the law and try to look at the technicalities. She said, well, okay, this rule means that you have military necessity on the one hand, suffering on the other. So far, so good. That's accurate. And therefore, she said, you would have to have an extreme military need on the one hand. If you look at the scales, go down like this. In order for the extreme suffering caused by nuclear weapons, down the scales, go down like this, to be able to justify such suffering. Which, on a technical level, I can see how she got to that kind of conclusion. And so she said, well, as a result of this, the suffering is not necessarily excessive because in an extreme situation, it might not be, it may be needed. That was her general conclusion. The problem with that approach is twofold. As I said, I can see how she got to there. So, I mean, you know, a lawyer can validly make that argument. But there are two problems with that conclusion. The first is that that approach assumes that you will make an evaluation, a careful evaluation, at every instance. Every moment you're going to do this careful analysis. Now, if you're looking at whether a weapon should be considered to be illegal, in the normal way, what states do when they choose to ban a weapon is that they will look at the normal intended use, not an exceptional use. They'll look at what it's usually intended for. And in that context, they will then decide, well, for the usual intended method, is the result going to be excessively harmful for that military purpose? And to try and make an evaluation at every moment involves a huge analysis, huge thought. Now, when it comes to nuclear weapons, in the normal way, and given what was mentioned this morning, that one has to sometimes make hair-trigger decisions if you're facing a nuclear strike, you're going to have to send it back. In 4 minutes or 8 minutes, are you going to make this kind of evaluation? Is the evaluation going to be done at every single moment? I don't think it's realistic. And although from a pure technical legal point of view, you could say, yes, okay, it's a question of each moment you evaluate the need, that is something which is problematic. The second element with that problematic thing is what Judge Miran Mantri said in his separate opinion. Has there ever really been a proper analysis of whether in the extreme case of when you really are losing the war and your back is against the wall, using this is going to win the war for you? Is it really going to happen? I don't think this has ever been properly analysed, because in order to make that kind of evaluation, you have to realistically think about it, not just come out with this kind of general thing, oh, well, in an extreme situation, you know, it'll fix this, we'll win the war suddenly. I don't know if that has been properly done. I have my extreme doubts. The second objection that I have to her evaluation is, I think, more important, and I think is actually the crux of the matter. And that is, has there been a proper evaluation now? That's to say, we're looking at 2006, whether modern conventional weapons could actually do the military need. And this is not very elegant English, I know. But the point is, you've got a military objective to achieve. Could a conventional weapon or several conventional weapons actually achieve the military need? Is there ever a situation whereby a nuclear bomb will do something that conventional weapons could not do? Is there such a situation? I have been told from quite a few military that no, in this day and age, with conventional weapons as they are now, with the kind of force that they have now and penetrability that they have now, then actually conventional weapons can do the military job now. If this is the case, and this really then becomes a crux argument, then a nuclear weapon will go beyond the needs that you need because of the long-term effects, in particular the long-term radiation effects, which go beyond the immediate need. And therefore, I think that if this is so, then the argument is made, in my view, that the use would cause superfluous injury or unnecessary suffering because of the long-term effects of radiation. Now, moving on to the next technical aspect, which is, are these weapons, are they capable of distinguishing between civilians and military? Now, I'm not going to talk about the kinds of things that were talked about before. Using one of these on a city, on a populated area, obviously not, because of the blast, the heat, all the rest of it. But that's not what states which in their submissions talked about. Judge Schwebel in particular talked about the usual two examples. The use against a submarine in the middle of the ocean was the one example, and the other was an army in the middle of the desert. No, but let's take on this. I mean, you know, as a lawyer, one shouldn't just say, never mind, I'm not going to look at this argument, it's too inconvenient. No, let's look at this straight on. The first issue is, then, what are indiscriminate weapons? Now, there are two interpretations of this. The one interpretation is the one which Judge Higgins used, and which tend to be used especially by the United States as well, and that is it possible to target a weapon? That's to say, is it possible to aim a weapon at a military target? If that's so, then it's not indiscriminate. Now, it is clear that nuclear weapons can be aimed at a target. So using that argument, and if they limit the understanding of indiscriminate to that definition, then they've fixed their problem. They say, no problem, it's not indiscriminate in nature. But that is not the only interpretation of what indiscriminate means. And the majority of judges, and I can tell you from the customary law study which I did, I looked at the majority of state practice around the world, introduces a second condition to what could be considered an indiscriminate weapon. As I said, the majority of states' parties do in their manuals, in their legislation, in what they've said. And that is, if the effects of the weapon, once targeted accurately at a military objective, if the effects are uncontrollable, unforeseeable, then that makes that weapon also indiscriminate, because one cannot realistically evaluate in advance what the effects are going to be. So it's the uncontrollable effects that also renders a weapon indiscriminate. And the obvious example of weapons which have been prohibited by treaty because of their indiscriminate effects are chemical weapons and biological weapons. Both those types of weapons can be targeted. You can target, if you like, a canister full of germs at a certain place. You can target chemical weapons at a certain place, but you cannot reasonably foresee the effects. Now, with nuclear weapons, that is precisely the problem. The effects do depend on the weather, such as, and the same thing goes for chemical weapons. The effects of radioactive fallout especially will go up into the stratosphere and fall God knows where. That is the part. In other words, the second aspect of indiscriminate is what is critically important when you're looking at nuclear weapons and their indiscriminate nature. Now, the next aspect was not mentioned that I want to talk about, was not mentioned in the primary opinion, but was talked about a lot by several judges and by several state submissions. And it's one which I want to talk about because there is a perversion, in my view, taking place in humanitarian law, which most people are not aware of, and I want to particularly address it now. And that is a reliance on the doctrine of proportionality. That is to say, there are too many persons, even teachers of humanitarian law, that teach, for the use of a weapon to be lawful, or for attack to be lawful, you have to look at two things. Have you targeted a military objective? And if there are collateral effects, collateral damage, are those proportionate or disproportionate? That's all you need to look at. Now, why am I saying that this is a dangerous approach to limit an evaluation to this? Because if you look at that, you then eliminate this second definition of indiscriminate effects that I talked about before. Now, I hope you'll try and stay with me on this, because it took me about an hour to try and get my students to understand with all kinds of diagrams on the wall and writing things. But the point is as follows. Proportionality, it means that, okay, you target your weapon at a certain place. Fine. That is a lawful military objective. But in order to evaluate whether collateral damage will be excessive for the value of the target, you need to be able to make an evaluation in advance, before you attack anything, as to what those collateral effects will be. You need to be able to do it beforehand. Otherwise, how are you going to make the evaluation? It is physically impossible. Because you're supposed to be able to weigh military objective, that importance. Collateral damage, that extent. Is this excessive, yes or no? But in order to be able to make that evaluation, you need to be able to know what the collateral effects are going to be. Now, the whole difficulty when you're looking at something like nuclear weapons is that you will not know the full extent of collateral effects. You cannot know in advance. How are you going to make the evaluation? You don't know the way the wind is going to go from one moment to the next. That's why chemical weapons were prohibited, by the way. You don't know how much is going to go into the stratosphere and is going to end up where. And this brings me back now to my submarine example and my desert example. One talks about, okay, a submarine in the middle of the ocean, not going to hit anything. Well, excuse me, yes, it is. The radiation fallout is going to affect a whole load of fish, for example, and sea life. That fish and sea life is likely to be eaten, ingested by people. And that is going to have an effect on their health. Apparently, what you eat is that much more severe than what you breathe in, because that I heard is another thing. How are you going to see that in advance? Perhaps the people who eat all that, some of them are pregnant. What effect is going to have on the others? You cannot foresee this. So I'm not convinced with the submarine in the middle of nowhere argument that this is not going to affect other people. How about the army in the middle of a desert? Well, again, let's say you have a certain amount of fallout with the dust. You have wind going in various directions. Yes, the effect might be less, but can you really foresee this? How much will go up into the stratosphere and lands, God knows where? Can you really foresee this? I don't think you can. The last argument that gets forced is, listen, folks, don't talk about your big megatons. These days you've got small tactical things. They can be contained. That's the last argument. Well, with the small little ones, everything's going to be fine. But having heard various opinions from physicists, there is no nuclear weapon, however small, that will not result in radiation that will be let out into the atmosphere, and especially if one intends to use it in a tactical way against a very small, specific object, you're likely to detonate it nearer the ground, which means that one is likely to end up with more fallout, in which case, even so, you still have the same problem of indiscriminate effects of the radiation going various places. So you cannot evaluate whether it's proportionate or not in advance, which brings me back to the fact that if you cannot tell in advance, don't buy this argument that the only rule is targetability and then proportionality. And as I said before, the majority of states in the world do actually have this other element of interpretation, the indiscriminate, unforeseeable indiscriminate effects. Now, the final one, because otherwise I'm going to be talking too long, and therefore I will cut a few things out, I want to talk about, is the reference to an extreme circumstance of self-defense that several judges talked about. Now, the interesting thing is the fact that in paragraph 42 of the opinion, the court actually said what is correct. Paragraph 42 says, a use of force that is proportionate under the law of self-defense must, in order to be lawful, also meet the requirements of international humanitarian law. It's not one or the other, or one trumps the other. The only judge who basically said plainly the use of nuclear weapons will violate humanitarian law, but never mind self-defense is more important, was Judge Fleischhauer. And I consider that to be extremely dangerous. You're going straight back to the old doctrine, which was in German, Kriegsraison geht vor Kriegsmanier, which means that the purposes of war are more important than the rules of war, which the Nuremberg Tribunal in three cases said this is completely unacceptable. And the majority of judges didn't accept that. But having said that, though, Judge Guillaume and Judge Schwebel appeared to imply that by going on about the importance of self-defense, even if they didn't put it quite so plainly as Judge Fleischhauer did. But the majority of the court, in their main opinion, did not say that. Both have to be respected. So the famous last paragraph is that if that's what they meant, but self-defense, you know, trumps humanitarian law, if that's what they meant, then it's contrary to what they themselves wrote in their own paragraph 42 and what the majority of judges actually said in their separate opinions is indeed the case, that you cannot have one more important than the other. Both have to be respected. If, on the other hand, the only other interpretation is what I would call the Higgins approach, which is that in an extreme circumstance, it might not be superfluous, the injury. Or in extreme circumstance, it may not be disproportionate. But I've already said what I think about that in my two previous analyses of those two particular legal points. So my opinion is that that last paragraph simply doesn't make sense. It's not coherent with their own opinion. It's not coherent with the majority of judges. And the most fascinating thing is that when you read all the separate opinions, how judges voted in no way reflected what they voted for and what they said. It's the bizarrest thing I've ever seen. With Judge Warren Mantry, I would say, is the only one who's really coherent there, and at least dissented and said why. I mean, even Judge Higgins dissented, and I thought that her opinion was the closest to actually the final paragraph, so I don't understand it. But never mind, that's all another matter. So I think I've used up my time, and I will leave it there for now. Thank you.